Welcome back to the weekend edition. It's 11:05. On the show now, we have a local historian, Sean Beattie. Sean, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Barry. How are you?
Sean, you're here to tell us about Enid Blyton's links to County Donegal. I suppose a lot of people wouldn't even know about this.
That's right, Barry. My house is full of Enid Blyton books. My kids are all the time reading Enid Blyton's books. And she is, in fact, one of the world's greatest writers of children's fiction. She would be way ahead of J.K. Rowling. She wrote over 600 books, and she used to write 10,000 words a day. So she's very, very prolific. And, of course, she's a quintessentially English writer. But her family roots are in County Donegal.
Yeah, so is this something you've delved into, and how did you come about finding this out?
Well, I continue to do research on local families and landlords and that type of thing. And I was in touch with a Dutch genealogist, and she pointed this out to me. She made a connection between Enid and the Carey family of Tiernaleague in Carndonagh. It's spelled C-A-R-Y. So Enid's great-great-grandmother was a woman called Mary Ann Carey, and she came from a place called Tiernaleague, which is just outside Carn. And Mary Ann's father was Micah Carey, and the Careys are all buried in the local churchyard, the Protestant churchyard at Dona, near where the Protestant, beside the Protestant church, beside the old cross. And they were minor gentry, so they owned quite a lot of the town. They built a lot of property around the town. So she had a fairly wealthy background, came from, highly respected family background. So those are the roots that we have for her in any show. And the Carey name continued then in the family right down to Enid's father. Like, Enid's father was called Thomas Carey Blyton, and her grandfather was called Thomas Carey Blyton. So the Carey connection is very, very strong, and we can assume that when Enid was growing up, that she would have heard stories about, you know, the Careys and about Ireland, and it probably influenced her writing. That's my theory anyhow.
I would say a lot of people who have read Enid Blyton books, a lot of people from County Donegal who have read Enid Blyton books, probably don't know about this connection.
Mm. Probably not, but she actually... We believe that the genes came down through the family from Mary Ann, because there were other writers in that family as well, based in Donegal. There's a man called James Norris Thompson, and he lived in Carndonagh, and he wrote quite a lot about, you know, about Mary Ann, and he also wrote a diary, a very famous diary, running to about several hundred pages, and he used to write down poetry there, and little stories. And he also would have recorded his impressions about Mary Ann. So these genes and this writing tradition ran through the family. James Norris is most famous for writing a diary, and his mother also wrote a lot of poetry. Her name was Mary Ann Rankin, and she wrote about things like shipwrecks and castles, and she was very anti-establishment. And in some ways, she reminds me of Enid Blyton herself. So, obviously, Enid would have inherited these characteristics from these family members.
Do we have any idea if Enid Blyton ever came to Donegal herself?
I don't think she ever came to Donegal. In fact, I'm not even sure if she came to Ireland. She died about 1968. But the amazing thing is that her books are so extremely popular. You know, she's very, very popular in the Northwest, very popular even today amongst school children. You find her books in children's libraries. But the things she writes about are, you know, about, she writes about fairy stories, she writes about the Famous Five, she writes about shipwrecks, she writes about castles. And a lot of these things crop up in the family history. So these things would have occurred, and sort of, she probably heard these stories about shipwrecks and about the family castles and so on. Another writer in the family was a guy called Joyce Carey, who lived at Redcastle. And in his day, the 1930s, he was as famous as Charles Dickens. And their main family home was at a place called Castle Carey, which is just right beside Redcastle, outside Moville. Now, it's not a castle, never was a castle. In fact, the building isn't there anymore. But the Carey name survives there in the name of the townland, Castle Carey. And she wrote, Enid wrote about castles, a lot of castles and, you know, magical stories. And I believe she was probably influenced, you know, by this family history when she was writing, you know, her stories about the Famous Five and all the adventures that they had.
Are Enid Blyton books as popular now as they once were?
Well, in her day, Enid Blyton had a kind of a field trip because, you know, she was the greatest writer. And there's no, well, television wasn't as extensive and printing wasn't as modern as it is now. So Enid had the field to herself. But nowadays, if you go into a, you know, if you go into an ordinary bookshop and you go to the children's section, you'll find the places coming down with books about all sorts of things, and they're beautifully coloured, and there's fierce competition. So she's competing against a lot of other brilliant writers. I mean, there's some Irish, of course.
And do they still read Enid Blyton in schools? I know in my time in school, there would have been a lot of people would have read Enid Blyton books even as part of the curriculum.
Yeah, well, my own school down in the school which is nearest to me, primary school in Kildaff, I was talking to the principal there the weekend, and she has all Enid Blyton books, well, quite a few of Enid Blyton books in her school library. So I was amazed to find that she still read, because, like, her stories are a wee bit dated, like they belong to an older time, and nowadays children are more into, you know, reading stories on iPads and, you know, books from Amazon and, you know, very high tech and large print and beautifully designed. But despite all that, Enid Blyton remains popular. She does remain popular, yeah, but not as popular as she had been, you know, in her peak in the early 1900s. But she still read quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, and the County Donegal Historical Society, while you're here, you had a book launch last night.
Yeah, we have, Donegal Historical Society has republished the journals that they printed in the 1950s, all six of them, and they're now available in one volume. We call it Volume 2, and it runs to 600 pages, and it's available in all bookshops, and you can go to our website, donegalhistory.com, anybody wants to order a copy, or get a copy in the bookshop if you want. So it is available now. Volume 2, Donegal Annuals, 1950s.
And just give us the website again, Sean, just for anybody who's interested.
The website is donegalhistory.com. So yeah, you can order through that, or order through your bookshop if you wish.
Okay,
you
know. And we'll put that up on our Facebook page for anybody who's interested. Sean, yeah, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Next up in the show, we've got career guidance. A survey has been carried out by the ESRI on where people get their best career advice and if the career advice they got when they were at school was good enough. We'll have that coming up next. Okay, on the show now, we have ESRI researcher, Professor Eimear Smith. Eimear, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Eimear, you've carried out a study on career guidance students receive. I suppose, firstly, where is the best place for students to get career guidance?
Well, at the moment, they get it extensively from their parents, because as young people move through the school system, they're making decisions all the time. They're making decisions about which subjects to pick for junior cert and then leaving cert, about whether to take higher or ordinary level for subjects, and then ultimately about what they'll do after they leave school. So the study we did actually predated the removal of the ex-quota provision for guidance counsellors. And even at that stage, there was a certain scarcity of guidance resources, so they tended to be focused on senior cycle. So as a result, young people were really highly reliant on their parents, especially their mothers, for advice as they moved through the system.
So is enough being done at second level schools regarding career guidance?
Well, as I said, at the time that we did this study, there was more provision in place than there is now, but resources were very much targeted towards senior cycle, especially sixth year and CAO application preparation. So it meant that some young people were getting to senior cycle and they had not picked the subjects they needed for options they wanted to pursue after school. They maybe hadn't taken higher level English and they would require that for whatever they wanted to access. So our research showed the importance of kind of guidance at an early stage, and in particular in kind of enhancing young people's aspirations, because we found that they tended to kind of form their aspirations about higher education fairly early on. And they were maybe doing that in the absence of much information other than what they got from their immediate family. Now, of course, as we know, things have changed since then, and schools now need to provide guidance from within their own resources. They don't have the additional allocation. So we're not really sure what's going on, but I mean, at an anecdotal level, guidance counsellors have been brought back into teaching more than they had been. And we, on the basis of our research, this would be seen as kind of having much more serious effects for those young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, because they didn't have people in their networks that had necessarily gone to college and that could help them navigate their way into higher education.
And I suppose how essential is career guidance then?
Well, it's absolutely essential. I mean, you need whole school guidance because young people are making decisions all along. So teachers, or regular subject teachers, it's important that they support that decision making. But ultimately, young people also need the kind of specialist advice, especially as choices of higher education courses have become more complex. We've got a really large number of different courses. So if someone wants to choose engineering, they really need, say, some support to know, well, what is the difference between electronic engineering and production engineering, and does it matter if which I pick?
And when it came to parents, was it mum or dad who gave the best advice? What did you find?
Well, in terms of what young people said themselves, that they were more likely to talk to their mothers about options, but they did talk to their fathers. And they were kind of equally likely to see their mothers and guidance counsellors as helpful. But the balance was different by social background. So middle-class young people were more reliant on their parents, and they had siblings as well who had possibly already gone to university and who could give them kind of insider information. Whereas for the working-class young people and then those from immigrant families, they were much more reliant on school-based guidance.
But is this not just life? This is what life is about. I know at the time when I was going to university, most of my friends were going and doing courses, and at the time they probably couldn't tell you why they were doing the course they were doing.
Life that, you have to make decisions as you move through, but you would want those decisions to be well informed. Because when we followed up young people after they left school, so 3 to 4 years later, we found that a very significant group, almost half, regretted the choices they had made. Now, sometimes that's because they didn't get the course they wanted. They didn't get the points. Sometimes it's because they wanted to get a job and they didn't. But sometimes it was because they went and took a course, they got into the course they wanted, but then they realised it wasn't what they expected. So we really want people to make informed choices, and it's a waste for them to, take a route they're not happy with. But, also there are implications for society if we have people who are going into courses that are taking college places that really don't suit them.
And did you find that a lot of people are going to university or college and the course that they participated in ended up not having any effect on the career path they then chose?
We weren't able with this group of young people to kind of follow them too much into the post-college pattern. But what we did find is that some young people were kind of picking subjects and they didn't have a great grasp of what was involved. A lot of times people are going on what they've heard from their immediate circles and, their interests, but they're also going on kind of what they've liked in school. But there are lots of, college courses that are not really related at all to what they've covered in school. So it's very difficult to know what something like law will be like, or, a subject like computer science may turn out to be very different from what people think it will be.
What's the best piece of career guidance Professor Emer Smith ever got?
Oh, what I got? I had quite a radical nun who was a guidance counsellor in our school, and she tried to encourage the girls to go into careers like law, and she actually was successful in getting quite a few of my classmates to go into engineering. But I'm not really sure. I kind of think I ended up doing something that I hadn't fully intended to, so that's not unusual either.
But you're happy in the career that you've chosen?
Oh, yes, very happy.
Yeah, it has made me think too, just when I was reading into the report, I can't remember getting any career guidance at school, really, that
really?
Had an effect on my career. I always wanted to be a sports journalist, and I ended up becoming a journalist, but I don't remember having any conversations with teachers in my school about it.
But sometimes young people can be quite clear about what they want. I mean, where guidance really comes into play is where people aren't too sure of what they want. And there are quite a number of options out there. And young people, when we ask them going through school, you know, what kinds of occupations they wanted to go into, they were really mentioning all the old reliables, like teacher, lawyer, doctor, etc. And not too much a kind of some of the, you know, emerging career areas that could be open to them. So I think it is, I think where it's important is kind of helping you navigate through the morass of choices, but also maybe challenging what you think you might want.
And if there is any young people who are listening now who are unsure about the career path they're looking to take, or they're unsure where to get advice, where should they go?
Well, that's a very difficult question. Really, as many different sources as possible, I would say. And possibly the best source of advice is someone who has done that course or done that job, you know, to really kind of know what it's like from an inside perspective.
Professor Emer Smith, ESRI researcher, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
On the show now, we have Captain Steve Allwright. He is an airplane pilot who is running a course for people who are afraid of flying. Steve, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Steve, where did this idea come from?
We've been running courses for 28 years, Barry, on and off in the UK and in Ireland, and more recently New York, Dubai and Johannesburg. It was the idea of a couple of captains who realised that some people have significant difficulties with flying, and we felt that we ought to run a course to help them be able to explore this wonderful world out there.
So does it work? Is it expensive? That's the questions people are going to be asking.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's not too expensive. It's €299 for the course, and that includes a 45-minute flight on a British Airways jet. And it's a 98% success rate. We have tremendous success, and we have some wonderful stories, people perhaps who have never flown or haven't flown for 20 years, people who are very claustrophobic, people who just don't enjoy it, regular business travellers who don't enjoy it, new mums, perhaps they've got the young little children and for the first time they start feeling anxious, and we want to help them fly with confidence. That's the name of the website, Flying with Confidence.
And can you give us some examples, Steve, of some of the people who've taken part in this course and got over their fear?
Well, we had a lady on the last course who was 70 years old and she had never flown, and she was in tears at the start of the day, tears of fear. And at the end of the day, she came on the flight. She had a wonderful time. She had grandchildren in Australia and she had tears of joy looking forward to seeing them. You know, I did a recent course in Dubai, and somebody had driven 6 hours to get there. We did a course in London where a guy had come from Moscow by train over about 40 hours. And they all go on to do extremely well. It's hugely rewarding, and it's great to see people enjoying flying. And, you know, the people that helped me on the course, we've got four Irish pilots, in fact, all running the course in Dublin on the 28th of March. And they all love flying, and they hope a little bit of that rubs off, you know, on the people on the course on the day.
So what is it you do to help people overcome their fears?
And the course splits roughly into three parts. First of all, we have what we call loosely a technical session. So the pilots will explain the theory of flight, you know, pilot training and testing, and explain how, you know, to try and help them to trust the professionals, because they're the most regulated profession on the planet. Also things like turbulence, that's our number one concern to people on the course. So we go into great detail about turbulence, why it's uncomfortable but never dangerous, weather, emergencies, how we control the flight, and obviously lots of questions and answers. That's the main thing people want, their questions answered. That's the first part. The second part of the day is run by a clinical psychologist. Dr. Simon Petrie is coming over from Scotland, and he's going to talk about fear and anxiety, the physiology, so why you feel like you do, why sweaty palms and racing heart, and the psychology behind that. And most importantly, teach some techniques which help break into the fear and help people control their anxiety, control their body and mind, so that they can actually get onto a flight and start enjoying flying like so many other people do. And then the third part, of course, putting it all into theory, putting the theory into practice, and going on a flight. And on that flight, they get a running commentary of all the noises and sensations that occur, on every flight, on a routine flight.
And of any famous people taking part in the course, I suppose when I hear about people being afraid to fly, the first person comes into my head, because I'm an Arsenal fan, is Dennis Bergkamp.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I remember that. We did try and get him on the course. He actually, I think it was so severe that he wasn't interested. We've had one or two rich and famous people who I can't disclose, but somebody that I can mention is Jennifer Aniston. She recently did an interview live on the Jimmy Kimmel show over in the States, and it's had 300,000 hits on YouTube when she actually declared that she's scared to fly, and that she watched our Flying with Confidence video on board a British Airways. Every British Airways long haul jet has the in-flight entertainment buried away in there is yours truly on an 8-minute video loop. If you really can't sleep, I said yes, you watch that, and I'll bore you to sleep. But if you're a nervous flyer, it's there for people that to reassure them about all the things that we mentioned on the day on the course. Anyway, Jennifer Aniston found it very useful.
So any of our listeners who are afraid of flying and who may be interested in this course, where did they go? How did they get involved?
Okay, so the website is www.flyingwithconfidence.com. All the information's on there. Just look through there. There's a whole section on the Dublin course. As I say, it's 28th of March. If you'd rather speak to somebody, we've got a UK number, 01252 793 250, and if you want to talk to somebody about your fears, whether you think it's going to be a suitable course, or indeed you can just go on the website and book online.
Captain Steve Allwright, thanks for joining us on the show this morning.
Good to speak to you, Barry. Many thanks indeed.
Captain Steve Allwright on the show there. He was talking to us about a fear of flying. And before that, we had Eimear Smith from the ESRI, Professor Eimear Smith. Just a text message in regarding career guidance. A texter says, I went to Pobol Scoil Gweadóir in the 80s and the career guidance was super. If you were a girl, all you were guided to do was nursing, and that was it. On the show now, we have the singing Cork barman, who has proved an internet hit this week after he was filmed singing an old Irish song perfectly in tune while he was still serving pints and running cash through the till. The man in question here is John Horgan, and John's on the line. John, how's it going? Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm not too bad. John, you've proved an internet hit this week. Did you ever expect that when you were singing in the bar and it was videoed that so many older people would then get to see it?
No, I had no idea. I didn't even know it was being filmed at the time.
So you had no idea it was being filmed?
No.
There you go. How did you find out that was then online?
Well, first of all, it was on Facebook Friday morning. And from there, different people started looking at it and contacting me by message on Facebook or text message. And from there, it just snowballed basically out of control.
And when did you start to realise just how many thousands of people had seen this?
Monday. On Monday morning, I got a frantic phone call from my daughter, Katie, say that, have you seen the Examiner online paper? And was basically saying how that the singing barman has had an awful lot of hits on the views in Facebook.
And just for anybody who hasn't seen the video, what was the song you were singing, John?
I was singing Jimmy McCarthy's song, Bright Blue Rose. It's a favourite song of mine. I'd often sing behind the counter, just singing away and serving away. It's a standard thing to do.
Yeah, and it's the bar you work in, it's the Crossroad Pub in Southeast Cork. It's trad sessions and you singing, that's a regular thing, isn't it?
Well, me singing is a very regular thing. So the trad sessions, the third Thursday of every month, we just have a trad session like that just to keep the tradition alive and keep the locals happy.
And I suppose they don't need the hiring bands or singers when they've got you behind the bar.
No. No, and like the place is so small, there's no point in having people hurt. And, the microphones and that would be just too loud here. So it's set up perfectly for a person singing on their own.
And how are you handling the newfound fame? I checked before we came on air today, or this morning. I think there's up to 250,000 people have seen this video.
I say you'll have to check again.
Is it more than that?
There's 530,000.
530,000. That's crazy the amount that people have seen it.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
And has it resulted in more customers coming to the bar this week, or has business been booming now as a result?
Well, there's a few extra customers coming in, just pointing, yeah, that's him. You know, after having a few drinks, then they'll pluck up the courage to ask you to sing a song.
And where do we go from here? Are you going to go on the Voice of Ireland X Factor?
No, I'd keep singing away behind the bar here. He's entertaining the locals and anyone that wants to call down to see me.
And when we have you on, you actually have Donegal connections, don't you, John?
Yeah, I do. I have an uncle living in Buncrana, Uncle Dennis. He's 95 years, been up there most of his life. I think he's stationed in Fort Dunray. And his five daughters, Denise, Nolene, Sheila, Pauline and Bridie. And then after that, numerous cousins.
So we must get you up to a pub in Donegal for a sing-song.
I've sang in Donegal in the past. I sang in Buncrana.
There you go. John, thanks for joining us on the show. And I suppose while we have you here, we might as well play the clip from YouTube. Thanks, John, for joining us.
Thank you very much, Barry. Bye-bye. Burn on the sea to understand.
And so it goes to ponder his death and his life eternally. One bright blue rose of Lissado, 2,000 years and still it grows. To ponder his death and his life eternally.
Okay, welcome back to the weekend edition. It's 25 minutes to 12 now. 25 minutes left in the show. In studio now, we have Siobhan Barber, a local Buncrana singer. Siobhan, good morning. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, so you're going to be on a talent show. It's a talent show with a difference on TG Cahir, a busker talent competition in Dublin. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, it's just you're playing for Ireland's best busker, apparently, so... That's it's just a talent competition, and we go down on Wednesday to record, and and you win 1,500 as well if you win, as well as that title.
So yeah, so. I suppose the titles were the main thing. Best busker in Ireland would be quite a title. And how did you get noticed busking, or did you have to apply for this?
We had to apply and then audition. We went down too late. Do you know what I mean? We applied too late even, and then it's myself and my boyfriend doing it, Jeremy. So we missed the Letterkenny auditions and we missed the Dublin ones. So we had to go down to Cork and learn a song in half a day, cut it down to 90 seconds. So.
And then when did you find out that you were successful?
When was it? I don't know. A couple of days later, they just rang us up and told us.
And when do you go down now to take part in the show? It's next week, is it?
Yeah, we are recording on Wednesday in Dublin. So that'll be good.
Are you nervous? Excited?
I'm a bit nervous now, but you know what I mean? Come the day, it'll just be good crack, you know what I mean?
And how many people are taking part in this? Is there quite a few?
Yeah, I think it's around 80 loads auditioned for it, but they have 80 that know.
And do you know how many auditioned for it? Have you any idea? I suppose if you went through all the buskers around the county, if they were all to take part, you would have...
No, there'd be loads. I'm not entirely sure of the actual number, do you know what I mean? But it's 80 and always that got through.
Yeah, and busking, did you busk around Buncrana or...?
I busked in Derry, and then once in college then we went to Galway and Dublin busking, do you know what I mean?
And where are you based? You're a student in Dublin?
In Maynooth.
In Maynooth, and would you busk? I know any time I've been to Dublin you always see buskers in the street. Would you be out there busking?
Well, we haven't now recently because there's this new busker law in, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right, I've seen that come on recently. So was it anybody who I've probably ever seen on the streets in Dublin busking could be your competition?
It could be.
Yeah, and are you looking forward? You're looking forward to it, you're nervous. When then do you find out if you've qualified? Like, how does the heats work? Is it eight?
I think there's 10 shows. And then one person from each show goes through to the semi-final, and then maybe there's four then the final. I'm not entirely sure of that, but anyways, eight people go through to the semi-final tonight.
And I know like a lot of these talent shows, like X Factor and stuff, people don't get to choose their own songs. Do you get to choose your own music?
We do, yeah.
And so what are you going to be performing?
I think we decided on Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
So something lively anyways. I think that's what they want, something lively. Oh.
And suppose you're here now, Siobhan, you might as well give us a song when
we
have it with you.
No bother. Okay. This is Little Bird. So.
Sings like a kettle, and your words they boil away like steam, and the lie burns long while the truth bites quick. A heart is built for both, it seems. I am lonely as a church, despite the queuing out the door. I am empty as a promise, no more. When the time comes and rights have been read, I'll think of you often, but for once I meant what I said. I was salted by your hunger, now you've gone and lost your appetite. And a little bird is every bit as handy in a fight. You are lonely as our memories, despite the gatherings round the fire. Are you every bird on every single wire? When the time comes and rights have been read, I'll think of you often, but for once I meant what I said. Here I stand, I'll lay me down on a house on the hill. I'm pulled from the rubble and kept from the kill. I'm pulled from the rubble and I'm kept from the kill.
Siobhan, thank you. It was great. Is that an Ed Sheeran song?
It's Lisa Hannigan.
Lisa Hannigan.
Yeah.
I was thinking the wrong song then.
Well, he does a song as well.
Yeah, he does it as well, yeah. And this is the kind of music you're going to be playing on the show?
No, this is just the kind of music
that
I like.
Yeah. And just tell us what you're going to be playing on the show again.
Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry.
And for anybody who wants to tune in?
I don't know when it's going to be aired, but...
You don't know when it's going to be aired, but you're going to be recording this on...
On Wednesday.
Wednesday. And for anybody who wants to follow you on Facebook or Twitter, who wants to find out so they can keep...
Well, there's a Busker Boo Facebook page.
Yeah.
I suppose if you just search Siobhan Barber, do you know, I'll be updating as well.
Yeah, and sure, we'll put a link up to her Facebook page and how people can follow the competition and stuff. Siobhan, thanks for coming in. It was great.
Do you mind if I just say a quick hello to my...
Work away.
Granny Barber and Granny Doherty, please.
Yeah, well, you've just done it. Or go ahead.
Yeah, there. Well, hello.
I'm sure they'll be texting now. Siobhan, thanks for joining us on the show. Okay. We're going to take an hour break. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome back to the Weekend Edition, 11:45. 15 minutes to go in the show. On the line now, we have a school teacher from Waterford called Enda O'Doherty. Now, I've heard of people doing things for charity before, but what... Enda is going to be doing is it's quite outrageous. Enda, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Barry. This is an introduction.
I'm stuck for words. I can't. It's hard to describe what you're actually doing. So I'll let you tell our listeners what you're going to be doing for Pieta House.
Okay. What I'm going to try, Barry, is on the 7th of June, I'm going to leave Belfast and I'm going to try and walk from Belfast to Waterford, which is about 9 marathons in 8 days, and to raise awareness for mental health issues in Ireland and to raise funds for Pieta House. I'm going to try and carry most of a washing machine on my back for the whole journey. So it's a strange undertaking, but a worthy one at the same time.
Why a washing machine?
Well, your listeners, Barry, who are married, will have had this conversation with their partner. But I said to my wife at the end of this summer, I had just finished Ironman Sweden, and I said I was going to go and do another event. And I said, I might do something for charity. And my wife said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'll walk from Belfast to Waterford. But when you're married, sometimes there's a little bit of banter can go on. And my wife said, is that all? She said. And like a lot of Irish men, I should have been a bit more sensible and kept my mouth closed. And I just said, joking, well, shall I carry a washing machine? And she said, well, go on then. And I said, I will. So
that's how the idea came about.
Yeah, 6 months later, it's taken on a life of its own. Here I am in Waterford on I was going to say in the sunny southeast, but it's very cold, very wet and windy down here, talking to the Weekend Edition in Donegal. Life is strange, Barry.
Well, it certainly is. Well, what's your friends and family saying about this? Do they think you're mad?
Well, they all know I'm mad. I've been mad for years. It's not a recent phenomenon. But no, in fairness, they're absolutely so supportive. The goodwill I've had from local businesses and now nationally from people saying, you know, it's a fantastic cause and you're doing something. I mean, one of my friends is coming with me and he said, look, I wouldn't miss it. He said, it's an epic journey for an epic charity. And he said, I want to be involved. And, you know, just back to your last question there, the washing machine, well, it's, you know, a lot of people, like you were saying, oh, my God, it's a long journey. And it is a long journey and it will be hard work. But, you know, there are a lot of listeners to your show this weekend who are carrying emotionally and personal loads far in excess of a washing machine. You know, I can always take that off and put it on the ground. But it's meant to be symbolic of the difficulties that people are going through in their daily lives. It's also a huge advertising space for our Pieta House text number and also for sponsors who might like to come on board. And of course, the real reason, Barry, is that it's sensationalist and to grab media attention. And it certainly seems to have done that, you know, that we've been on radio shows all over the country in the last day or two and newspaper articles, whatever. So the washing machine was specifically designed to grab the media attention. And it has, thankfully.
And that's it, and that it definitely is. It's an original idea which has caught people's imagination.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, the charity Pieta House provide counselling to people who are suicidal or who are self-harming. Free of charge. It's an amazing, amazing charity that, you know, they're literally saving people's lives. The school I'm teaching in here, in the last few years, regrettably, we've lost 2 students. And, you know, while any funeral is sad occasion and, you know, they're painful to go to, you know, to see the parents of those kids, for me personally, it was a horrendous experience. And if we could prevent that happening in our own city or in Donegal or anywhere in Ireland, you know, for one family not to go through that, I think it's a really worthwhile endeavour. The other reason, as I said, at the start was to raise people's awareness to mental health issues. You know, like the numbers are terrifying, but they need to be spoken about. You know, 1 in 4 of us will experience a mental health issue in our life, which means if it's not you, it's certainly going to be your brother, your sister, your, you know, your partner, your best friend. And we need to be aware of that as a society, that we need to be stand strong together. The other thing is that in Ireland, I think the numbers are running at somewhere 10 people per week are taking their own lives. And, you know, if that was happening in nightclubs or supermarkets or on the road, there'd be huge public outcry and huge government action on the issue. And I just feel so strongly that, you know, we sort of brush it under the carpet. We don't talk about it. It is uncomfortable and it is a difficult subject to deal with, but I think we have to deal with it, you know.
Yeah, and you speak about how your own school was affected. I'm sure teachers, students and even the family members of the people who were affected must be very proud that you're doing this.
Well, I don't know. It's a funny thing. I mean, you know, I have set myself up, I suppose, as a figurehead for leading this and organising it. And we have people who are going to walk the full 8 days with me from Belfast. We have people, we're looking for people to walk for an hour, a day, a week, whatever they feel physically up to or whatever they have the time to do. And I've, as figurehead for this, I'm shocked at the amount of people who have come to me with their own, you know, tragic stories, or people who've come to me looking for help. But like I said to you some minutes ago, very well, I'm just a regular, what's my wife called, a man having a midlife crisis covered in Lycra. one of those guys you see on the road wobbling. I'm not Superman in any shape or form, but I'm not elite athlete or anything like that. I just think this is a really important cause, and I think we can do good as a country if we can get up off our bums and do something about it. I think it's a solvable problem.
And you were just saying that other people can take part. How?
Absolutely. Well, if you can, we have a Facebook page, and even if you can't walk, you can simply click like and share on Piesa Challenge. And the Piesa Challenge is our Facebook page. Our website, which should be finished this weekend, is www.piesachallenge.webs.com, and all the information is there. And as I said, people can donate. We have a text number. We have mycharity.ie. Put in ENDA and Piesa Challenge. They'll find and they can make a donation there. That they can text. What I love what's happening, Barry, is that people are taking the walk to heart and organising their own events. So I have, I know of a Tchaikovsky concert, Tassica concert coming up in Kildare that's been run, and they're kindly giving me the proceeds. We got the proceeds the other night from one of the Cheltenham preview nights here. I know of another lady who's having a fantastic reggae night. She's having Jamaican food and Jamaican music and, you know, something totally different. What I want people, like people have said to me, you know, I'd like to give you a tenner or give you a 20, and it's great, all those add up. But what I want people to do is partly to discuss the issue and then maybe to get involved themselves, because that's a more powerful movement altogether if we have people, you know, getting actively involved.
And I suppose just one final question, and how do you train for this? Are people seeing you running around Waterford with a wash machine on your back?
They will next week. Next week I will be out on the road, and I expect to have bras and knickers and everything else thrown at me. Ireland is a great place for humour. Some of the comics have been great. My favourite one so far is a fellow wandered over to my wife in the gym the other night, and he said he's well able to carry it, he said, but I bet he's not able to turn it on, which I thought was good. But the training is involved at the moment. I've been at it now really, I suppose, about 5.5 months. It's a lot of heavy lifting, a lot of specialised lifting. Actually, you can see some of the lifts on some of the machines that we're using with my trainer, Conor MacDonald. He's a local personal trainer here. He's got fantastic equipment. So I've been lifting heavy about 5 or 6 nights a week, but I'm also walking with weighted walks. So, for example, last night I would have done 13 miles, a half marathon with 30 kilos in a bag. So my marathon, half marathon time, I think, is about an hour 45 normally, but I'm back out to just under 3 hours 40 for a half marathon now. So it's going to be about an 8 or 9 hour walk every day for the 8 days.
Yeah, it's quite a vigorous task you're taking on.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I know if any of your listeners have taken part in endurance events, you know, there's a truth in that most people aren't aware of. Lots of people are talking about getting back to Waterford, and sure, there'll be great celebrations if I get here, but for me at the moment, the big pressure is getting to the start line, because there's a little bit of snow on the roof, Barry, I put it that way now, and I'm 47, and the legs and the bum hurt a bit in the morning. But if I can come out of the Europa Hotel on morning one with a smile on my face and some of my friends around me, that'll be a great achievement on its own.
And you'll be doing this, it's in June, and sure, hopefully 7th of June. Hopefully we can speak to you and again before then.
But absolutely, I'd love that, because I'm sure. I'm looking forward to meeting people on the journey. I'm looking forward to hearing their stories, and I know that I know Highland Radio listeners aren't a million miles away from saw me in Belfast, maybe some of them might consider coming and walking to Banbridge on the first day. Well, the second day is Banbridge to Dundalk. Then we go Dundalk to Drogheda. Then we go Drogheda to Lucan, down to Newbridge, Carlow, Kilkenny, and hopefully home.
Okay, and I'm sure listeners will. And as I say, hopefully we'll get you back on the show between now and the 7th of June. But Enda O'Doherty, thanks for joining us on the show.
Barry, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it. Thank you.